loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, in a classified leak to the Washington Post, U.S. intelligence officials say that North Korea is constructing new missiles at a factory that produced the country's first intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of reaching the United States. Is North Korea rearming, or is the intelligence community trying to kill the warming of relations between the two countries? Next, British journalist Robert Fisk recently concluded an investigative report on weapons deliveries to belligerents in Syria, including ISIS and Al-Qaeda. He found that many of the weapons, including missiles and rockets, were made by U.S. defense contractors and sold to NATO and friendly countries in the region. They were then sent to Syria in violation of end-user agreements. Then, Puerto Rico's government last night reached a deal with a bondholder group to restructure more than a third of the $9 billion debt owed by the island's electrical utility, PREPA, as it moves toward privatization. Economists say the deal, while helping Puerto Rico in the short term, will likely lead to an overall increase in the rates of interest poor cities, states, and territories must pay on bonds. And then President Trump yesterday lashed out at the billionaire Koch brothers, two of the Republican Party's most prolific fundraisers, calling them, quote, a total joke, unquote, and saying that he never sought their support because he didn't need their money or their bad ideas. MSNBC host Joe Scarborough said the outburst points to Trump's destruction of the Republican Party. Why would the president provoke such a fight within his own base? And finally, the U.S. military's Africa Command, or AFRICOM, which is based in Germany, announced yesterday that it had begun deploying armed drones to Niger earlier this year. Niger agreed to the request as part of its joint counterterrorism work with the U.S. But why did it take so long to release the information? And why is AFRICOM nowhere near Africa? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Korea. In a classified leak to the Washington Post, U.S. intelligence officials said that North Korea is constructing new missiles at a factory that produced the country's first intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of reaching the United States. Is North Korea rearming, or is the intelligence community trying to kill the warming of relations between the two countries? We're joined from New Zealand by author and Professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. Tim, welcome back.
Good to be back, Brian, John.
Tim, this is a very Washington kind of leak. The Washington Post cites as its source, quote, officials familiar with the intelligence. So these are anonymous sources.
Wait, but John, Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos.
That was my next point. It's owned by Jeff Bezos, who has a $600 million contract with the CIA, an equally large contract with the Pentagon, and is probably, through the Washington Post, the leading anti-Trump mouthpiece in the country.
And before and after Bezos took possession of the Washington Post is alarmed. The Washington Post neocon editorial writer,
Fred Hyatt.
Yeah, they're alarmed that peace could break out on the Korean Peninsula, Tim. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, you're quite right. And mind you, of course, it's not merely the Washington Post. The whole mainstream media is worried about peace breaking out, as, of course, is the Pentagon, the military-industrial complex, and so forth, and all these people who make their money out of stoking up fears about war. In your intro, you said something about a new missile. As far as I understand from the Washington Post article, they're not even claiming new missiles. They're just claiming work on existing missiles. There's no
and they even better than that, they said the possibility of.
That's right. Yeah.
And this is what's so ridiculous.
Yeah, well, I mean, they take photographs in space.
Yes.
Of buildings, and then they decide what they think's in them. In that same Washington Post article, they talked about a research institute, which they claimed a couple of months ago was doing uranium enrichment. But the article admits that European intelligence experts don't agree with that. So, I mean, who knows what they're arguing about? Who knows what, you know, real evidence they've got? But that's not really the point, is it? I mean, the point is that this is all part of the pushback against the Singapore summit, against the possibility of peace. So I don't think we should get too sidetracked on the minutiae of, you know, the missiles and this and that, because these stories will keep on coming out. That's the point is that they want to derail any movement towards peace.
Yeah, that is the story. Of course, it's the story, because this is really, when you think about, these are anonymous intelligence sources, which means it could just be made up by people who are opposed to it. And yet it becomes like such a big article today, Tim, in the Washington Post. So Americans are reading and they think, ah, North Korea's cheating. And here's another one. These are real gems from the unnamed intelligence officials. And again, I would say the phrase intelligence officials should be considered an oxymoron. But let's listen to these words from the Washington Post. Instead, senior North Korean officials have discussed their intention to deceive Washington about the number of nuclear warheads and missiles they have, as well as the types and numbers of facilities, and to rebuff international inspectors. This is what is being done in the back rooms by North Korean officials. Their strategy includes potentially asserting that they have fully denuclearized by declaring and disposing of 20 warheads while retaining dozens more. The basic message here is, again, by unnamed, unsourced sources who are obviously opposed to any sort of deal with North Korea, you cannot, in an existential way, come to any agreement with North Korea because they lie, they cheat, they steal. That's the message.
Of course, the point is, of course, they don't, obviously don't know about these. If there were private discussions, they wouldn't know anyway. We know that American intelligence on North Korea is pretty shonky. They keep on getting blindsided, so wouldn't take that too seriously. But while we're talking about missiles, I don't know if it's really surfaced yet, but apparently there was another Minuteman test, I think yesterday, an American ICBM test from, I think, Vanderbilt across the Pacific. So this is going on at the same time that they are complaining about that North Korea's not denuclearizing fast enough for them. So the hypocrisy is pretty astounding.
You are exactly right. I just Googled it, and there was an article from 1 hour ago saying Minuteman III missile test launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base ends in failure.
Yeah. Ends in failure.
The missile exploded. Ends in failure. It exploded.
Oh, well, perhaps they should ask North Koreans for some help on developing their missile.
You know, I want to go back to a point that Tim was also making. These are important points. The U.S. says, do as we say and demand, but not as we do, because we do just the opposite.
That's right.
I want to go back to the point that Tim made, which is the American intelligence on North Korea sucks.
It always has.
It's really bad. I'm going back because I wrote about this at the time. Kim Jong-il died in 2011, and he was dead for a while. And the CIA and American officials had no idea.
No idea.
That's how limited their actual knowledge is of what's going on in North Korea. And the headline of BBC News on December, for our listeners, December 21st, 2011, Kim Jong-il death, : did U.S. intelligence fail? And then it says U.S. analysis were still uncertain of Kim Jong-il's death some 48 hours after his demise early on Saturday morning. Now we're going to trust the same intelligence sources. And by the way, Tim, you remember the stories how Kim Jong-un's wife was unhappy that his ex-girlfriend existed, and then she was like fed to the dogs, except...
Well, something like that. And
but then she's appearing now in concert singing.
Yes.
But that story ran wild for about a month.
Absolutely. Well, in this sort of climate, you get people making up stories for all sorts of reasons, to make money, to persuade their bosses they know something. I mean, all sorts of plausible reasons why people do it. And since none of it is really verifiable, they get away with it. But, I mean, you're used to that. You see Russiagate, for instance, or whatever. It's happening all around you, all around us. All these unsubstantiated stories which really have very little traction on reality as far as one can see. And, it's fairly transparent, the motives behind it.
Tim, let me ask you, do you think it would be appropriate for the Washington Post at the end of an article like this, quoting unnamed U.S. intelligence sources, to have a disclaimer that says, Jeff Bezos, owner of Amazon and current owner of the Washington Post, has a $600 million contract with the CIA?
That would be asking a bit too much, wouldn't it? Yeah. But yes, it would be good if we could have disclaimers like that, yeah.
Again, Tim, where do you think it's going? We have about 2 minutes left. I mean, North Korea has done all of these unilateral acts, showing good faith. They're expecting reciprocity. Obviously, there's a lot of blowback because the U.S. establishment is so scared that peace could break out. But where do you think it's going? Do you want to make any predictions?
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, I think the Chinese and the Russians, I guess, too, are going to loosen up on sanctions. So that's a very positive step. We have these current talks between the North Korean and South Korean military, which have ended without a joint statement, and apparently continued disagreement over the northern limit line issue, which is important. We haven't got time to discuss it. But there is a certain movement in South Korea, but then things here are, you know, on the knife edge, because we've had the planned coup, which they lost their nerve and something didn't happen. And so we have the question of, you know, what Moon Jae-in is going to do about that and so forth. So there are all sorts of uncertainties floating around. The only thing we can be certain about is that the U.S. establishment, military establishment, civilian establishment doesn't want peace.
The last 60 seconds, Tim, you just said something that piqued my interest. Why have we not heard anything from the South Korean government about this? Is it because it's not true or because they don't want to make waste?
Sorry, about what?
About the notion that the North Koreans are testing these new missiles or building old missiles or whatever it is they're being accused of doing.
Well, I mean, yeah, I don't know if they've got the entire... I think they presumably rely on the Americans, and the Americans rely on them for certain things. I think the Moon Jae-in is trying to keep a... He's trying to be an intermediary, but, you know, he's not really working because he can't really break with the Americans. But even so, there's a bit of cautiousness, I guess, about going too far out on the American limb. Yeah, I mean, these are rumors. We know the purpose of them. And it is interesting, as you say, that the South Koreans have not come out in support of them, as far as I know.
That was the voice of Professor Tim Beale. He joined us from New Zealand. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
British journalist Robert Fisk recently concluded an investigative report on weapons deliveries to belligerents in Syria, including ISIS and Al-Qaeda. He found that many of the weapons, including missiles and rockets, were made by U.S. defense contractors and sold to NATO and friendly countries in the region. They were then sent to Syria in violation of end-user agreements. We're joined from the U.K. by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former British ambassador to Syria. Welcome back, Ambassador Ford.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Ambassador, can you walk us through how something like this would happen? I understand that NATO countries, friendly countries in the Middle East, are going to buy U.S. weapons. But then how do they make their way to Syria and into the hands of known terrorists?
Well, it's fairly clear that the authorities in the Western countries concerned have simply turned a blind eye to what they knew was going to be a passing on of these weapons to terrorists. They must have known. They cannot not have known. The world knew that Saudi Arabia was supplying ISIS and all these other jihadi gangs in Syria with weapons for them to sign off on these deals. For arms that are not even stocked in the Saudi military, it shows clear connivance and just going around these countries' own laws. That's in the case of the U.S. and the U.K. This is being gun running on a major scale, comparable with Iran-Contra.
Brian, he took the words right out of my mouth. This reminds me very much of Iran-Contra. And it's funny, I think we ought to assume that at least one of the countries that was involved in Iran-Contra, Saudi Arabia, is involved in something like this. Everybody has known for many, many years that the Saudis play both sides against the middle. And they're involved in financing, at the very least, I believe, in arming many of the groups that here in the States or in the UK or elsewhere around the world are considered to be terrorist groups. And then there's never any fallout. There's never any price to pay. I wonder why that is. Ambassador, can you comment on that?
Well, it's a failure on the part of mainstream investigative journalists, if that's not an oxymoron. I don't think the mainstream do much real investigation. It's a simple lack of interest on the part of the media and opposition parties, whether it be Democrats or Labour, because they've been prepared to go along with the prevailing narrative about Syria and turn a blind eye to support, more or less overt support, barely disguised support for very questionable extremist radical Islamist organizations.
You know, there's been more weapons sold, John, by the United States in the first 6 months of 2018 than sold in the entire year of 2017. And I think if we went back and looked at the trend, it's not simply because we have Trump instead of Obama.
Oh, no.
I think what we're seeing is that this is a major source of profiteering for U.S. companies.
I agree completely.
And these are favored companies. These are patriotic companies.
These
That's
are right.
The national security establishment. And then the other part of it, in addition to this naked profiteering, is the fact that unless the arms are in the hands of people who have been demonized by the United States propaganda machine, the United States is probably perfectly happy with the weapons being exactly where they are because they're being used, say, in the case of Syria, against the entity that the United States was really targeting, which would be the Assad government.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when the U.S. government says in 2011 and 12 and 13, Assad must go, Assad must go, Assad must go. Well, how would he go except by armed factions fighting him, fighting the Syrian Arab army? And how would they fight them without weapons? And where would they get the weapons but for and but from the United States and NATO countries? It's a studied apathy when the reports come out, Ambassador Ford, by the same sort of pro-war propaganda machine known as the U.S. Mainstream media.
Exactly. And there are a couple of striking aspects to these revelations. One is that the source of the arms, or the conduit for the arms, has been Saudi Arabia itself, a fountainhead of jihadi Wahhabi-inspired extremism. This makes it even more egregious that the conduit has been the fountainhead. And then secondly, when you look at the detail of what these weapons are, they almost turned the tide of battle in Syria. The tow anti-tank guns are very deadly, and there was a moment in 2015, I think it was, when things were looking very black for the Syrian government. In fact, this was probably what brought in the Russians. Now, here's an interesting aspect. The fact that we were gun-running through the Saudis into Syria precipitated the entry of Russia with everything that has ensued. What goes around comes around.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the bottom line.
It's sort of a geostrategic equivalent of karma.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all like to think, not we personally, but our foreign policy leaders here in the States like to think that they're the smartest people on the planet when it comes to diplomacy. And this is an example that proves that they're just simply not. Because either there is no policy or the policy is so deeply flawed as to probably be criminal. I mean, we have laws in this country that prevent material support from getting to groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or the Nusra Front or any of these associated groups. And American weapons are clearly getting to these groups. And there's no price to pay. Nobody's being prosecuted. There's no federal investigation. This should be on the front page of the Washington Post. And it's not.
It's not just that there's not a price to pay. There's a profit to be
made. There's indeed a profit. And in fact, Robert Fisk identifies Raytheon as the company making millions of dollars from the provision of these weapons.
I want to read a little bit from the report that Robert Fisk filed with The Independent. And again, it really, you know, why is Robert Fisk one of the few investigative reporters going into East Aleppo? And here's how he opens his story. Readers, a small detective story. Note down this number, and then he gives a long serial number, and then this number, and then another number. I found all these numerals printed on the side of a spent missile casing lying in the basement of a bombed-out Islamist base in eastern Aleppo last year. At the top were the words Hughes Aircraft Company, founded in California back in the 1930s by the infamous Howard Hughes, and sold in 1997 to Raytheon, the massive U.S. defense contractor whose profits last year came to $23 billion. Shareholders include the Bank of America, Deutsche Bank. Raytheon's Middle East offices can be found in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Israel, Egypt, Turkey, and Kuwait. Okay, now later on, he's looking at these numerals. Fisk is looking at the numbers. He says, let's trace them back. Here's my little detective story. And he says, even if I can find it, however, meaning he's missing one number, I can promise readers one certain conclusion. This missile will have been manufactured and sold by Hughes Raytheon absolutely legally to a NATO, pro-NATO, or friendly, that's in quotes, power, and there will exist for it an end-user certificate, an EUC, a document of impeccable providence, which will be signed by the buyers, in this case, the chaps who purchased the TOW missiles in very large numbers, stating that they are the final recipients of the weapons. These are traceable. Go ahead, Peter Ford.
Yeah, the words speak for themselves. And you didn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to do this investigation, just that nobody was interested in doing it.
Exactly.
The evidence was there in hiding in plain sight if anybody had wanted to look. But of course, a willful blind eye has been shown to the sale of these missiles, which as I say, almost turned the tide of war. And God help us all if ISIS had entered Damascus. In fact, they did enter parts of Damascus. This is what the onslaught by the TOW missiles on the Assad government tank forces, they decimated them. It was only when the Russians came in the tide turned again.
Ambassador, you are a career diplomat. When you are involved in strategic thinking about the direction of British foreign policy, do you not think about the issues of blowback or a plan B or how you want the policy to finally culminate? Because it seems to me in the United States, we do things like these weapon sales, and we really don't think about how we want this to end or the potential for blowback. Are we unique in that respect, or are countries sort of in the dark over their long-term diplomatic initiatives? We have 1 minute left.
I wish I could tell you that you're unique, but in my experience, the British are just the same. Short-termism and political expediency. I'm sorry. The same geniuses that brought us Iraq, the Blair government and the security agencies behind them, along with Bush and the security agencies on the U.S. side. It's the same geniuses who brought us this fiasco over the smuggled weapons into Syria.
Well, we should probably leave it there. We were joined from the U.K. by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former British ambassador to Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Puerto Rico's government last night reached a deal with a bondholder group to restructure more than a third of the $9 billion debt owed by the island's electrical utility, PREPA, as it moves toward privatization. Economists say the deal, while helping Puerto Rico in the short term, will likely lead to an overall increase in the rates of interest that poor cities, states, and territories must pay on bonds. We're joined from Kalamazoo, Michigan, by Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez, Department Chair and Associate Professor of Anthropology at Kalamazoo College. Welcome back. Good to have you, Professor.
Good to be with you.
Can you explain to us what this announcement about PREPA's debt actually means? It's a little bit confusing. Is this good for Puerto Rico or is it bad?
Well, it depends what part of Puerto Rico you're talking about. It is good news, certainly, for PREPA, for the power authority, as it was able to negotiate some drawbacks on its debt, meaning that debt holders were willing to take a hit, at least in the short term, in favor of stabilizing the utility in the long term. And they were offered some assurances in terms of the returns returns that they would see on their investment in that long-term range. However, for the people of Puerto Rico, the people who pay the bills that the electric utility sends out, it is not very good news, as it certainly involves a raise in fees and in the price of electricity for consumers in Puerto Rico. Now, there have been some assurances that there would be other kinds of measures taken that would counterbalance those fees, but it seems very difficult to imagine a way in which the debt gets paid without raising the fees, raising the price of consumer electricity for Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico.
Frequently, when debts are restructured as well, there are cost-saving measures that are implemented at the same time, and frequently those cost-saving measures include laying off workers, since salaries are usually the biggest expense. Do you see that happening in this case?
I think that's likely. There have not been any announcements to that regard yet, but we all know that this is part of the process of privatizing the power company in Puerto Rico, and it's not clear how that privatization is going to take place. Last week, there were hearings in the Senate in the Committee on Natural Resources, and one of the senators, the senator from Puerto Rico who was present, Eduardo Batia, when he was asked about privatization, his response was, well, privatize what exactly? Because the electricity company, the equipment that it has is so outdated, obsolete, and so damaged that it seems difficult to imagine that anybody would want to actually buy the physical, you know, the physical property. So really what we're talking about is we're talking about control over the monopoly of service in Puerto Rico. And that's a different kind of restructuring, a different kind of privatization. I'm not familiar with any other processes that had happened quite like this before. And part of that has to do with the fact that Puerto Rico is a captive energy market. It's an island. And so it has certain kinds of limitations in terms of how power distribution can happen, meaning that power generation has to actually occur on the island. And so there's many different possibilities about how this could end up playing out in terms of the privatization. But in terms of the workers that work at the Puerto Rico Utility Company, I think the future looks grim. The employees union is a very strong one. The PREPA union, UTIER, is a very strong one. And if this company is privatized, we could see the demobilization of UTIER, of that labor union, which I'm sure is part of the intention here.
Adriana, another question. Puerto Rico has very limited options, given the fact that it has, in essence, a colonial relationship to the United States. It could be, if it were an independent country, a whole myriad of options. But on the other hand, it would also and could anticipate being severely punished economically by this great power, the United States, which has done so to other countries, Cuba, for instance, or in many ways towards Haiti, in fact. Is there a way out for Puerto Rico in terms of sort of a new relationship, a different relationship with the United States, either as an independent entity or in some other way?
Well, there are many possible futures for Puerto Rico, and we are living in a moment right now where it is difficult to imagine that the United States would support a peaceful transition to independent or free Puerto Rico. But that has been the case historically for the last 120 years. And this year, just in July 25th, was the 120th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Puerto Rico. So in some ways, things are more complicated and harder to imagine that future now. In other ways, it's more of the same, right? So I don't think that the Trump administration is likely to support a peaceful democratic transition to independence for Puerto Rico. But ironically, we might see something like the U.S. Congress deciding to revisit the territorial clause under certain kinds of economic pressure, or other kinds of scenarios become possible to imagine today that in the past have been pretty much unimaginable. And so there's openings both to the right and to the left in terms of Puerto Rico's future. But Puerto Rico has the fundamental right to self-determination. And that right has been over and over violated by the United States. And it continues to be violated by the United States as it makes determinations in Congress without consulting the electorate of Puerto Rico. So whatever the future of Puerto Rico is, it has to be one in which the people of Puerto Rico fully participate in the determination of what it should be. Some people in Puerto Rico want Puerto Rico to become a state of the United States, the 51st state of the United States. My father is one of those people, and it's very common within families that people have disagreements and different ideas about this. Some people feel very strongly that that is around the corner. Personally, I can't imagine the current U.S. administration deciding to admit Puerto Rico as the 51st state into the union. However, Trump at a meeting jokingly said, we'll do it if you can guarantee that the two senators that we'll get would be Republican senators. And certainly, I think that there's a lot of political machinations to make that appear possible, even if it's not actually possible, to make it appear possible that Puerto Rico would go Republican and therefore to make Puerto Rican statehood more attractive. In terms of what would happen if Puerto Rico were to become independent, certainly I think that there would be a long process, a difficult process of adjustment. Puerto Rico might face, as you say, economic or other kinds of political backlash from the United States and from its allies. However, I think fundamentally the international community in the United Nations and elsewhere has agreed that Puerto Ricans, again, have the right to self-determination. And so ultimately, whatever the political or economic cost of that would be, it certainly would fall within the rights of Puerto Ricans to make that decision for themselves, and not to the U.S. Congress, which continues to argue that Puerto Rico is a possession, literally a possession of the United States, and therefore that they can make these determinations without the consent of the Puerto Rican people. And that is clearly a situation of colonialism. And that is the situation that is behind this process of privatization. That is the legal justification for the austerity measures that are taking place in Puerto Rico. That is the justification for the PROMESA law, which was again upheld recently by the U.S. federal courts on the basis of the territorial clause, which is nothing other than naked colonialism.
Professor, I wanted to ask you about the politics involved here, too. Politico ran a piece this week indicating that the Puerto Ricans who moved to New York and to Florida in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria largely have not registered to vote in those states, and that as a result, the Puerto Rican community as a whole in both Florida and New York are not going to be as powerful as they otherwise could, and thus unable to affect policy. Is that your experience? What are you hearing about politics within the Puerto Rican community? And do you think that the community is strong enough to demand action when the next hurricane hits and devastates the island?
Yes, I think that Puerto Ricans had the experience of coming together across the globe. I personally was in communication with people from Spain, from the Netherlands, from New York, from Texas, all over the place, coordinating the sort of self-generated relief measures. So I do think that there are networks in place for support and solidarity for Puerto Rico, although they're not as active or powerful as they could or will be. And at the same time, it is true that Puerto Ricans have been politically disenfranchised for so long in terms both of its relation of Puerto Ricans' relationship to the United States and in terms of the local politics in Puerto Rico, which have been a kind of ping pong game between different corrupt parties that really stand for the same thing, ultimately, which is continued U.S. colonialism. And so people have a certain kind of disenchantment, if you will. It's funny, Puerto Rico is called the Isle of Enchantment, but there's a certain kind of political disenchantment that I think traveled with people from Puerto Rico to the United States in the diaspora. And you have to remember that these are folks that are coming from a situation where many of them have lost their homes. They've lost all their savings, everything that they had been working towards their whole lives, their cars. They've lost family members. And they're really, many people are still in survival mode. Even, we're coming up on 10 months or almost a year later. And many of those folks in the diaspora are still living in temporary housing or looking for work or trying to find some kind of foothold in what is a very difficult economic situation for poor people in the United States. And of course, around the world as well. And so I think that there is a certain kind of disconnect from the formal political system in such a way that leads people to kind of think, well, what I need to focus on is the circumstances of my life. And I'm not really, I don't believe in politics or I don't believe politicians. So why even bother? So I do think that there's some work there that communities in the U.S. can do, the diaspora can do to educate our people, to get people mobilized, to get people, registered to vote. I do think that is important. But again, that is not necessarily going to affect directly the situation in Puerto Rico, where the political system is basically overrun by the Fiscal Control Board, which is an instrument of the Congress.
It is. It's an example of Washington control, really. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. That was the voice of Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez. She joined us from Kalamazoo, Michigan. She's the department chair and associate professor of anthropology at Kalamazoo College. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump yesterday lashed out at the billionaire Koch brothers, two of the Republican Party's most prolific fundraisers, calling them, quote, a total joke, unquote, and saying that he never sought their support because he didn't need their money or their bad ideas. MSNBC host Joe Scarborough said the outburst points to Trump's utter destruction of the Republican Party. Why would the president provoke such a fight within his own base? We're joined here in the studio by Eugene Puryear, the host of Sputnik Radio's By Any Means Necessary. You can hear that Monday through Friday from 2 to 4 p.m. Eugene, welcome.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Eugene, nothing that Donald Trump says should surprise us, but frankly, this surprised me. Why would he take on the Koch brothers of all people?
Well, I think the reason why he would take on the Koch brothers is to actually hide the fact that he's working extremely closely with the Koch brothers. This is a very interesting shell game that the Koch brothers, who I think are very smart strategists, are playing, but 44 people in the Trump administration have close to or direct ties to the Koch brothers network, as it were, which is very large. Mark Short, the former head of legislative affairs in the White House, who is now at the University of Virginia, to much controversy, he was directly working for the Koch brothers for years. Vice President Mike Pence, deeply tied to them. And the roadmap for repeal that the Koch network, I believe it was Freedom Partners, actually put that out around repealing regulations and the like, has essentially been the roadmap for the Trump administration regulatory policies. Mick Mulvaney at the OMB, also deeply tied to the Koch brothers when he was in Congress and in different ways. And so I think in a concept of draining the swamp, I think Trump is looking to say, look over here, but don't look at the fact that the Koch brothers and myself are really deeply intertwined.
And draining of the swamp notwithstanding, Donald Trump actually did seek the money and the assistance of the Koch brothers. It's being reported today on Politico that he actively sought the Koch brothers' support and was denied that support.
Mm. Interesting. I mean, it certainly, I think, is not surprising. I think just about everyone is seeking their support. And I mean, maybe the bigger story, I think, in this whole thing is how much the Koch brothers have created this, and I think the post-Citizens United era, this massive apparatus of other billionaires and people with hundreds of millions of dollars to create a multi-level, multi-issue, highly coordinated operation that goes from everything from election data collating and usage and parsing voters to pushing policy reforms to reaching out to minority communities with free market ideas, quote unquote free market ideas, right wing Republican ideas. So this massive network with billions of dollars that's become extremely influential, and not just among Republicans either. It's primarily amongst Republicans, but you look at issues like prison reform, sentencing reform, a huge amount of that has been driven by the Koch brothers for reasons that we can discuss in different ways, but certainly it's also influencing Democrats as well. So it's a massive corporate influence operation that it honestly should scare people.
Ronna McDaniel is the Republican National Committee chairwoman, and she said something on one of the television talk shows this morning that I think is very interesting. She also took a shot at the Koch brothers. Mm. And she said that, quote, it's very disappointing to see yesterday that they are not going to support Kevin Cramer in this all too important North Dakota Senate race. They're ideologues. They're not just supporting Republicans. They're also supporting Democrats. In fact, the Koch brothers also financed the Libertarian Party and are very generous there. So what's the big deal? The Kochs have their own personal interests, their own personal business and political interests. So they support a Democrat every once in a while. The Democrats that they support are actually generally supporters of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the Kochs are supporting a broad ideological agenda for what they want to see this country go to. Almost no taxes, almost no no regulations, essentially a playground for people to produce corporate profits. And I think it's worth noting here that I'm not surprised that Romney McDaniel would say this, because this is also an example of how in the post-Citizens United era, the party committees are becoming less relevant. The RNC, the DNC, the D-Trip, all of those. Because now if you have $1 billion, it used to be that to get this big money in major ways, you had to have these umbrella organizations to collate the fact that people could only spend but so much money. But now that someone like a Foster Freeze, who can sit as a completely random furniture, hundreds of millionaire type guy in Wyoming, could make Rick Santorum a legitimate candidate for months beyond the time that we knew he was in 2008, people say, who cares about the RNC? They don't want to do what I want to do. I'll set up my own little mini RNC. And so I think for people like Romney McDaniel, this is actually sort of a crisis of great proportions to see these sorts of funding networks emerge.
The Kochs said over the weekend at a gathering that they hosted in Colorado Springs that they intend to spend $400 million of their own money just in this election cycle. They're undaunted by complaints by the RNC or Donald Trump. They're going to do what they do, and they're going to spend this money.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're developing it's been interesting to see how this has played out. They're developing this very intense sort of voter file, essentially, as they would call it in politics. I think it's called I-360. And it's existed for a couple years. And Koch Industries has been at great, great pains to say, we have no connection to this. Although, interestingly, now on the Koch Industries website, they are hiring data analysts to work for this I-360. So I don't know exactly how this is going to work legally, but they seem to be building up a massive voter file, which, for people who don't know politics, can then be used and parsed in many different ways to try to influence candidates and tip elections. So it seems like they're also playing the long game very heavily with these huge investments of reaping the benefits of gaining all this voter information and turning it into a larger and larger universe, which they can then use to help other candidates win, which would then be another added factor over and above money of why you want to cozy up to the Koch brothers.
See, and that is a longer term strategy than what the White House is proposing, because the Koch brothers really are looking at 2, 3, 4 election cycles down the road. Interesting, the only comment that came out of the Koch organization since Donald Trump's tweet storm, and I'll read the tweets for our listeners in a moment, was the network's co-chairman, Brian Hooks, the Koch brothers political network. Brian Hooks, he says that he laments the tremendous lack of leadership in Trump's Washington and the deterioration of the core institutions of society. Mm. So they're not laying down for Donald Trump. They're taking him on. I wanted to read these tweets because I think they're so hilarious. It's a two-part tweet from Donald Trump this morning. He says, quote, the globalist Koch brothers, who have become a total joke in real Republican circles, are against strong borders and powerful trade. I never sought their support because I don't need their money or their bad ideas. They love my tax and regulation cuts, judicial picks, and more. I made them richer. Their network is highly overrated. I have beaten them at every turn. They want to protect their companies outside the U.S. from being taxed. I'm for America first and the American worker, a puppet for no one, two nice guys with bad ideas. And then Ken Vogel wrote in Politico, fact check, false. Trump's campaign most certainly did seek support from the Koch brothers during the campaign, but the Kochs froze Trump out. Mm. I wonder if this is just some delayed payback. I wonder what he's so angry about.
I think I certainly would be not surprised if he was angry that he was snubbed. I certainly would not be surprised if this was an attempt by him. I mean, Trump is fully in election campaign mode right now. And I think his strategy, which, by the way, the Wall Street Journal took him to task for this morning, is to sort of mobilize the base with this kind of rhetoric. And I think he sees this as, hey, a great opportunity to remind people who Trump is supposed to be, and also to keep them from knowing the reality that he's actually raising money at a record clip for a bunch of super PACs, dark money type operations from all of the swampiest of swamp type people. And this is a great way, I think, by ginning up a fake fight with the Koch brothers. And it's great for the Koch brothers because it makes them look nonpartisan. It makes them look issue based. It makes them look exactly how they want to look, not as rank ideologues, but just as people who care about the country. So it's actually a great little, it's like a feud in the hip hop industry these days, which is totally ginned up by both record companies to juice up the record sales. That's how I see both parties in this
one. That's interesting. Or like before any heavyweight fight.
Hype. Every heavyweight fight, every camp that ever happens, some guy comes out who is a sparring partner with broken ribs. I've never seen anyone hit this hard before. Every time, every fight.
Yeah. And here's the, I agree. To use your expression, John Kiriakou, Eugene is exactly
He's
right.
He's exactly right.
Why is Trump so much more popular with Republicans than past presidents? This is the front page of the, or not the front page, a big story in the Washington Post today. There has been an effort often by Republicans skeptical of President Trump's administration to explain why Trump consistently sees approval ratings among members of his own party that are so much higher than past presidents. The only Republican who's been this popular with Republicans is George W. Bush, like 24 hours after September 11th.
Right. Wow.
I mean, and so you see, and I think you're right. This is why I think Eugene is exactly right. I think Trump is in campaign mode to the people who he identifies as his political base.
Yeah.
And that's what he's doing. He's saying, look, I'm a maverick. I'm anti-establishment, even though he's a billionaire and fighting for the billionaires and redistributing wealth for the billionaires. I'm your guy. I'm for the American worker. I'm not a globalist.
Yeah, I think that's 100% the case here. I think that we can look at so many of the different things that he has done. I mean, from the tariff issue and the way that's kicked up to the money going to the farmers. And certainly, I think that's a former New Deal program, which in and of itself excised a lot of Republicans. I think he's actually sort of playing on a lot of the differences he knows that he has with establishment Republicans. And also, in terms of backing people in these primaries that are going on, you look at Brian Kemp in Georgia, you look at Rick DeSantis in Florida. He seems to be trying to turn the whole political conversation more in a Trump-like way to really throw that red meat, to fire people up. I mean, it's completely random that Rick DeSantis has become the most anti-Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez politician in the country. It makes no sense, but it's making headlines. He's a big Trump ally. And so the whole political environment, I think, is being turned here by Trump to this red meat style, base identifying, fired up piece. And I think Republicans who don't get in line are going to find themselves being moved out of the way, like several people have, including whoever that guy was who was up against Brian Kemp in Georgia, who was leading until Trump just dropped a Twitter endorsement.
Leading until the last 48 hours of the campaign. You know, and this
He's down by double digits.
Yeah, now. Right. We've said this before on the show. We only have a few seconds left, but we should say it again. The Democrats underestimate Donald Trump at their own peril. These numbers from within the Republican Party are very, very telling. We think we're divided now. Wait until 2020 to see divisions in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, if the Democrats think that it's going to be a cakewalk in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Wisconsin, et cetera, they're in for another rude awakening. We should probably leave it there. I think we're pretty much out of time. We were joined here in the studio by Eugene Puryear. Eugene's the host of Sputnik Radio's By Any Means Necessary. You can hear that Monday through Friday from 2 to 4 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. The U.S. military's Africa Command, or AFRICOM, which is based in Germany, announced yesterday that it began deploying armed drones to Niger earlier this year. Niger agreed to the request as part of its joint counterterrorism work with the United States. But why did it take so long to release this information, and why is AFRICOM nowhere near Africa? We are joined from Massachusetts by Vijay Prashad. He is the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief editor of Leftward Books. He is the author, most recently, of The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution and Red Star Over the Third World. Vijay Prashad, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Yeah, good to be with you. Thanks.
Thank you. What's important about this story?
Well, it's important that it's been revealed to be happening. In other words, It's important that the United States government has had to admit via Niger that there are armed drones in the heart of North Central Africa. It's not that important that we know this now, because in effect, it's been known for a very long time inside North Central Africa that the United States is running a major military operation. This military operation, the United States has admitted, is supposed to be about Al-Qaeda, that is the Al-Qaeda operation in the Maghreb region. But other people have other ideas, and we can talk about that if you'd like. But I think the most important thing is this should not be a surprise to anybody. After all, not long ago, a couple of maybe four U.S. soldiers were killed in Niger. When that happened, you know, we heard even in the Senate Arms Services Committee, we heard horror and shock. Why are there U.S. troops there? So I'd just like to say that this is not a revelation for the people of North Central Africa, but it seems to be consistently a revelation for a population that is becoming increasingly, you know, with amnesia about its military operations in Africa.
Yeah. Well, and Gore Vidal famously said that the USA is the United States of amnesia. The four American soldiers who were killed in Niger in October drew attention to the fact that there are, drew attention again, as you're pointing out, maybe perhaps in a small way in the U.S. media, but not certainly to the people of the area, the country, the region. The U.S. has hundreds of troops in Niger. You know, interestingly, Vijay, it says they're there to fight ISIS and Al-Qaeda. I was looking at Robert Fisk's report, investigative report in The Independent, where he was tracking the serial numbers on missile casings from Aleppo, from East Aleppo, after it was liberated from armed Islamicist factions there. And he traced the casings back to U.S. arms manufacturers and other arms manufacturers inside of NATO countries. So here you have the U.S. government, either directly or perhaps indirectly through Saudi Arabia and other entities, supplying weapons to groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, or certainly not caring that much, not taking account of the fact that they're getting U.S. weapons, fighting entities like the Syrian government that have been also targeted by the U.S., and then using these same groups as the pretext to intervene now directly militarily with soldiers and bases and drones and armed drone operations. It seems, you know, to be all doublespeak. Is there another motivation, a real reason that the U.S. is there in Niger and in this part of Africa?
For sure. And by the way, just to be clear, it's not merely the United States that's in Niger, but the French have an enormous presence in this belt that runs, you know, across the Sahel region of Africa, the region just south of the Sahara. In fact, the French have an even larger presence than the United States. The United States in Niger has a very large drone base, perhaps the largest drone base that is there in Agadez, which is just near the capital, Niamey. It's in Niamey that we have this particular drone base where they have admitted to the use of armed drones. So it's not that it's only the United States, it's also the French, who have a very large presence there. You see, the thing is that when I've reported from the region, what I've learned is that in places like the Sahel, there is, of course, an Al-Qaeda presence. But this Al-Qaeda presence is largely a bunch of gangsters. I mean, it's not clear that they are as much a terrorist force as they are, you know, a force of, say, cigarette smugglers and so on. But they are, of course, a problem. But that's not the main problem as far as the United States and French troops are concerned. It seems that there are two other issues that are very important to put on the table. One of them is the movement of migrants from Central and West Africa and East Africa into the Mediterranean region, coming into Europe. This is a major concern for the Europeans, which is why the French have such a large presence there in this region. Essentially, they have brought in their troops, militarized the troops of the various African countries from Mauritania all the way out to Chad, and are using them you know, as a way to create a European border in the Sahel. But the second reason is, I think, equally important, and we've talked about this before, and this has to do with the, you know, the movement of drugs, particularly cocaine from South America through the Sahel into Europe. It's something that the Department of Drug Enforcement in the United States has been very concerned about. And there's no question that the U.S. troops are there as part of a drug crackdown program. So there are other, I think, very pressing issues which I wish could be talked about publicly, such as the anti-immigrant issue, the question of drugs and so on. Instead, one has this red herring of fighting Al-Qaeda, and that just closes the conversation down.
Indeed. Vijay Prashad is our guest. So the Sahel is that belt of countries, not at the very northern part of Africa, but in the northern section of Africa, right below Algeria, Libya, Egypt. We're talking about Mali, Niger, Chad, Sudan, right? And this is a significant part of Africa. What we're also aware of, Vijay, is the French have been in Africa for a long time, as you're pointing out. When you think about AFRICOM being located in Germany, it's kind of bizarre, especially when you think back, when one thinks back to the Berlin Conference of 1884, where the European non-African countries, along with the United States, sat down and drew up the map of Africa and decided which part of Africa would go to which of the colonial powers. And within 18 years, almost all self-governance in Africa, maybe with the exception of Ethiopia, vanished. Again, here's AFRICOM in Germany. Why Germany?
Well, look, frankly, I think that this is the easiest thing to explain. There is a great residue in many African countries of anti-colonial feeling. Now, this doesn't mean that the governments or the elites in these countries share this anti-colonial feeling, but this feeling is very deep in the populations of many of the African countries. And it has been very difficult for the United States government to get any country, apart from Djibouti and a few other places where there are basing agreements, it's very hard to get them to accept, you know, an African command, which is not just a base, a place to have your planes or drones come and refuel and so on. I mean, you know, you can have a base in, say, Agadez in Niger, and everybody can know it exists. And you can have feeling against that base. But the moment you say, we're going to create the U.S. African command in Niger, there's going to be a lot of negative feeling. I mean, you know, the negative feeling is not just in these countries which have not had a relationship with the United States. The negative feeling is also in countries like Liberia and Sierra Leone, where the United States has had a very close relationship for reasons, of course, having to do with the enslavement of people and then the movement of some people back to Africa. So I'm just, emphasizing here the point that let's not underestimate the sense of anti-colonial feeling that people have. Whether they're able to act upon that feeling adequately is a separate issue. I think there's a lot of frustration among populations. You know, you can go and talk to people. There's a frustration that they can't, there's no avenue for them to demonstrate the anti-colonial feeling. You know, the political parties in much of the continent has failed the population. They don't carry that standard, I think, boldly enough. So this is the real reason why the United States has had a very difficult time locating African command in Africa. On the other hand, it has been able to, of course, have bases there.
Yeah, that's so important. I think I've heard, at least, that the United States asked almost every country that it had diplomatic relations with whether they would host AFRICOM, and I think there were no takers for exactly the reason that you've stated. Vijay Prashad is our guest. Vijay, given the fact that there is a strong, deep, profound anti-colonial sentiment in Africa, even if there's a weakened anti-colonial movement, how much of an influence will AFRICOM have, say, in Niger and the other countries? We have just 30 seconds left.
It will have an impact because the elites are very, very open to basically selling out the infrastructure. I mean, the French and the Americans have come there and thrown money about. And I think the elites are going to open the door as wide as possible. The question is, will the population shut that door? And that's to be seen.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Massachusetts by Vijay Prashad. He's the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief editor of Leftward Books. He is the author of several books, including The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution and Red Star Over the Third World. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com. And we're a podcast at iHeartRadio, iTunes Radio, and Spreaker. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.